Any team that's tested AI tools for data has seen the pattern already. AI gives a different number than your BI tool. Metrics don't match across teams. And inevitably, users lose trust. It turns out, turning on AI is easy, but making it work on data is not. Hex AI was built to solve this. The key is nailing context. Hex is built to unify and curate your data context for agents. Data teams can observe, govern, and continuously improve every AI answer, so answers get smarter the more your team asks. The result? Your entire organization asks data questions in natural language and trusts the answers. Not because the AI got lucky, because it knows your business and its data. Because that's what an AI analytics platform should do. Join data teams from Cursor, Lovable, Ramp, AWS, and over 2,000 more at hex.ai.
And so I made it to the barn, and when I got in there, it was like an old tool shed, really. And there was a tractor in there, and there was a tarp folded up on the tractor. And so I got the tarp out, and I was like, I'm just going to wrap up in it and try to conserve some of my body heat because I was shivering so hard. And so it was a dirt floor in the barn. So I was like, I'm going to curl up in a ball and just try to get as warm as I can and put this tarp over me and try to trap the heat in. And that's the last thing I remember for the next 4.5 hours. I lost consciousness at that point, probably just between hypothermia, the head injury. Yeah, I was out. Later on, I found out that 4.5 hours had gone by. I was stunned. I couldn't believe it.
Before we dive in, just a quick favor. If you're enjoying what we're doing at Angels Among Us, please take a second to rate and review the show. And if something in today's episode touches your heart, please share it with a friend. Welcome to Angels Among Us, the podcast where we share real stories of angelic encounters. Each episode, you'll hear firsthand accounts of divine protection, guidance, and miraculous interventions that remind us we're never truly alone. Whether through a whisper of comfort, an unseen hand of protection, or an unmistakable presence, angels are closer than we think. Join us as we explore these powerful experiences of angels, both seen and unseen. Hello, hello. Welcome back to another episode of Angels Among Us. Brent and Michaela here as your hosts, and we are joined by Stephen and Nicole Johnson. We are excited. This is a referral from Mariah O'Brien. So Mariah, if you're listening, thank you so much for introducing us. I know a bit more about their story than Michaela does. She always comes into these blind, and she gets the first reaction. I'm always a little jealous. But I don't know a ton. I know little bits and pieces, so I'm excited to hear the whole thing, your experience. If you are here for the first time to listen to Stephen and Nicole, we would love for you to stick around. We have lots of amazing, incredible stories. If this is your first time again, also, we would love for a review, a rating. It just helps get us out to more and more ears, and that's what we're here for. We're here to help everybody to know that they're never alone. So, Stephen and Nicole, I will turn it over to you. Give a brief introduction. Tell everybody a little bit about yourselves, about your family, and where you're from. And then go ahead and jump right into your story.
Okay. Well, my name's Nicole Johnson.
I'm Stephen Johnson.
And we just celebrated 22 years of marriage on the 1st, May 1st. Yeah, we have two kids. We have a 20-year-old and a 17-year-old. So we're kind of entering a new phase of life, empty nesters.
Nearabouts.
Yeah.
We live in Ashland, Missouri, which is pretty much smack dab in the middle of the state. We're in a little patch of the Mark Twain National Forest. And we just love doing, being outdoors. We like to go camping, hiking, things like that. And our kids do as well. So we're always taking them on trips around the country to do different things.
Yeah. All right. Well, our story starts on April 29th, 2017. At the time, our kids were 8 and 10, we think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we were having just torrential downpours that weekend in Missouri. And this was, that happened on a Saturday. We had had heavy rains Friday afternoon and all into the evening, and the kids had made some little play boats, and we had taken them outside. We have a creek that borders our property, and they had been playing with their boats in the creek, and so we knew that the water was moving pretty good, and we would go out there during breaks in the rain. And the kids and I did that on Friday while Steve was at work. And on Saturday, we went out to show him. So my son, Steve, and I went out to the creek, and we followed Lane's little boat down around the side of the property and realized that the water was going pretty quick in this. Normally, it's a dry bed. It's a dry rock creek bed. When it rains, it fills up with water and it washes on down. And so the water was probably about maybe 5 feet deep at this point, and it was moving pretty good. And I was like, this looks like I could put a kayak in it and go down, you know, because growing up, I used to do borderline whitewater kayaking with my dad in Wisconsin. When the snow would melt off, the waters would get, you know, pretty turbulent. And so I was kind of used to that. Had never tried it out on our property, and normally we would stay away from the creek because it would, you know, fill up pretty fast, but it looked doable. And in my mind, I was thinking we could put the kayak in on this side of the property, and about, I don't know, a football field down the way, we have a path from our house that goes down to the creek that I could stop there. We could pull the kayak out. And if it was fun, we could go back and do it again, kind of like sledding. You put it in, you go down, get out, come back, go around. I thought it was a great idea.
I did not think it was the best idea, actually.
He's kind of like, I don't know about this. We'd never done it before. And I was like, oh, I'll be fine. It looks fun. And the mistake I made that day is as a kid, when my dad would do it, he would look at the route and make sure that the route was clear and that there were, you know, that it was a safe route. We wouldn't just get in the water and go. He would check it out. Then he'd come back to the house and get us and we'd go. I did not do that. And begrudgingly, Steve went up to the house and helped me get the kayak. And I'm a very strong-willed person, so he did say it was not a good idea. And I was just like, oh, you're being a party pooper.
She would just drag it down there anyway.
So I would do it myself. Yeah. So he's like, well, I might as well be a witness to this. So we get the kayak down there, and I'm like just so eager and raring to go that I think he got his phone out to record it. And as I'm getting in, the water just pulled my kayak in. And so we didn't really even talk about, wait a minute, where do you want to help me get the boat out? I just kind of went. And so we have a video clip of me going off in the creek.
Yeah. I had my camera pulled up already. So she jumped in, and I didn't realize the water had pulled her. I thought she just like, oh, let's go. And she was excited. And I was like, oh, what? So I got my phone up and recorded it real quick. But then as she went around the bend, I realized, wait, we didn't talk about where you're going to stop. Like,
yeah,
I kind of had the idea of where you might stop, but I knew that's when I really noticed that the water was kind of up, and Lane was still there. Our son was still there watching us. So I was like, I'm going to have to take him back. Back to the house, cause I realized it was so high that I couldn't go forward. I'd be at risk of slipping in the water or something. So,
cause we were kind of up on as the water goes, the land kind of goes up high. And so he didn't really want to take Lane up there.
Yeah. Our trail that comes down has like a 4 or 5 foot like climb up kind of a straight wall where there's a rock. And that was all just underwater at this point. So I had to take about 10 minutes to kind of backtrack to how we gotten down there, get him back to the house, and then go back down to the creek again.
So I get in the boat, and as I go, I'm going along, everything's fine. And I come around a corner, and that was my first obstacle. A tree had fallen across this creek. And so I went to navigate around it. I tried to do a sharp turn to the right, and I almost made it around it, but the back of my kayak caught the lead, the branches, and it rolled my kayak. And in a situation like that, it happens. You roll it, you pull yourself back in and you keep going. But that's when I realized how strong the current was. My kayak was gone. And almost immediately. I was pushed up. It was what I would call a sapling tree, just, you know, maybe like that big around. And it had kind of bent in the water, and the water just kind of pushed me up into it. And all of a sudden I'm sitting in this tree, and I'm like, oh, well, this is kind of a weird situation. My boat's gone. And I look across the creek, and it's about 10 feet across. But now, knowing how strong the water was, I was like, I don't think it's very smart to try to just swim across to the shore. The water's really going. And so I was like, well, I'll just sit here and wait for Steve to realize I'm here, and he'll have to run up to the house and get a rope and throw it in. He'll probably be mad at me, but, you know. So I'm sitting there in the tree waiting. I yelled for him a little bit, but the water was so loud. And he wasn't coming, and he wasn't coming. And I maybe sat in the tree for 5 to 10 minutes. As I'm sitting there, all of a sudden I hear this like kind of rumbling sound, and I look up, and the water came around a bend, and it was now like rolling. It was full of branches and trees and debris. And as it was rolling towards me like this, there was trees in the shoreline that were coming down, like just being pulled into the water, kind of like my boat was pulled in, like sucking in. Mm. And I just saw it coming at me. And I probably watched it come at me for about 15 feet. I was just like, no, 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 no. And it just hit me. It felt like someone just body slammed me out of that tree. And in an instant, I was now like, it was just chaos. It was bubbles. It was branches. It was trees. It was, I finally got my head above the water and realized what was happening. And I was being washed down with the water. And I was trying to grab at anything, all the debris that was all around me. But these were like full grown tree trunks. And as I would get thrown up over it to try to grab it, it would either rip out of my arms, or if I would get it, another tree trunk would come behind me and just smash me between the two. And luckily I had a life jacket on, and so that some of that padding helped. It would like knock the wind out of me. And so I was trying to grab at things, and then I at one point looked up and realized there was another tree that had fallen across the creek, a large tree. And it had a gap about that big, just enough for me to go under. Well, again, because I had a life jacket on, I was so buoyant, I couldn't duck down under the tree. And so I just smashed headfirst into that tree. Later on, they told us the water was going about 15 miles an hour, maybe faster. And As I hit that tree, I heard a squish sound. It sounded like inside my head. The only way I can describe it is if you were to cut like a chicken breast, a frozen chicken breast with a knife, and it makes that kind of squish sound, crunching, kind of a crunching sound. And I remember thinking as I hit that, I wonder if I'm bleeding, because I'm like, that sounded like it. I wasn't feeling any pain at this point, but I was literally thinking, wow, I wonder if I'm bleeding. But really, that blow to the head should have knocked me out. Like, it should have just knocked me out cold.
I can't believe it didn't knock you out.
It should have absolutely, to get hit in the head like that hard. And they told us later that should have knocked me out. And if that had happened, I would have drowned right then and there. But I kept on going and continued to try to grab branches. And, you know, all my efforts were fruitless. Like, there was nothing I could do. The water was so incredibly powerful. And I just can't emphasize that enough to people who haven't been in that kind of water, how powerful it is. It's just, you have no control at all. And at one point the water had gotten so high, we're up in the tree line now. So I'm like up in branches. So the water had to have been like 10 or 15 feet deep at this point.
Wow.
And at one point I got sucked down into the branches underwater. And so it sucked me down into the branches. And now I didn't know if I was upside down, right side up. I was underwater and all I could see was bubbles, and I could just hear. And I was just thrashing, trying to get to the surface of the water. But I didn't know where the surface even was at this point. And at this point, my thinking just slowed down. It was like all slow motion. I thought, this is how I'm going to die. And I was not afraid at all. I never felt fear at all. I am a believer and I'm a woman of faith. And so perhaps that, you know, is why I knew I was going to go, but I was profoundly sad. I was just this deep, just grief that my kids were going to not have their mom and Steve was going to have to raise them without me. And how could I have put them in this situation? One second, you know, I was in control and now I'm not. And now my kids are not going to have a mother and my husband's not going to have a wife. And after I thought, I pondered on that, then it was like, well, this is how I'm going to drown. And how does drowning take place? Like, what do I do next? I'm still trying to like process and be in control. Like, how do I drown? And I remember thinking, well, I guess when I can't hold my breath any longer, I guess I just take a breath and that's the end. Like I take in water and was literally thinking, what does it mean to drown? I'm going to drown now. What is that? What's that going to look like? And how does this go? And right when it got to the point that my lungs were burning so much that I thought I was going to have to take a breath, I just popped up to the surface and I took a breath of air. It was just coughing and sputtering and, I just didn't really have time. It kind of like time caught up again. And it was like back to, all right, we're surviving. I just remember trying to take really deep, slow breaths and then coughing as hard as I could to get the water out of me. And as I was doing that, I was trying to keep my head above the water. So I had my life jacket and I was trying to pull it down because it was wanting to come up. And I was looking up in the sky and the rain had stopped at this point. And there was a bird just soaring up above, just really slow, just soaring above me. And I just was thinking, I felt so small and insignificant. It was that profound sadness, but also now just profound loneliness. I just felt so small and insignificant out in the wilderness. I'm going to die out here and the world's going to go on around me. Birds are going to fly in the sky and animals are going to, you know, move around and I'm somewhere out in the wilderness. They may or may not find me. And, that's just how slow and methodical my thinking was. But at that point I calmed down and I relaxed and I was like, I need to quit fighting this. I just need to stop fighting so hard. And just cause I realized the water, when I calmed down and just relaxed, I would go up and over the rocks rather than just like bash into everything and trying to grab at everything. And so I relaxed and I tried to keep my feet going downstream. And as I did that, like I said, I started to kind of go up and over things and around bends. And later on, we found out I went about a mile and a half total down this, wow, this stream. And as I was looking downstream, all of a sudden there was a rock cliff, maybe 20 feet, 30 feet, just like a slate. What do they call that? Black rock cliff. And the water hit it and went 90 degrees the other way. So, but as it hit it, some of the water splashed up onto the shore and some of it kept going. So it was kind of like splashing like this. And I didn't even have time to think. I hit it with my feet and it just catapulted me up onto the embankment. And all of a sudden I was on my hands and knees on the shore. And I was like, I don't even know what I was thinking. It's like, I got to get out of here. I'm alive. I got to get out of here. And so now I started to scream. I was absolutely hysterical. Didn't know where I was. I was out in the middle now of Mark Twain National Forest. Cause again, our property borders Mark Twain National Forest. And so the creek now goes into the middle of it. So it's this massive wildlife area. And so I just start wandering. I'm screaming. I'm hysterical. I was starting to shiver because the water, now the temperature started to drop and it got down to about, I think, 43 degrees. And so I was starting to feel, the water was very cold. It was April. And the rain started in again. And
I can't believe you got into that water in the first place.
I'm not going to get wet. I'm just going to go sledding. I'm just going to go down and come back. So I found a barbed wire fence and I was like, well, this is a good sign. If I follow this barbed wire fence, it'll probably lead me to somewhere, a house or something. And at one point, as I was following it, it became like a pasture. And so I went under the barbed wire thinking, okay, this is a pasture. This is a farm. If I, you know, cross this pasture, I'm going to get to a house. And so I crawled under the fence. And as I wasn't feeling any pain yet too. That's like, people are like, how could you walk? Like I wasn't feeling pain yet. And, I didn't really know how injured I was. I hadn't even gotten that to that point to see what was going on.
Cause you had been hitting like rocks and.
Oh yeah. Like I was later. I mean, there wasn't a spot on my body that was not bruised.
I think you said you got squished between two logs in the water, just like pancaked you.
Yeah. The two logs. Yeah. So I'm walking across this pasture and I'm coming up over a hill and all of a sudden the ground starts like vibrating, like rumbling again. I'm like, and all of a sudden these black Angus cows come running up over the hill. And I'm like, are you serious? Here I survived this flash flood. And now I'm going to get trampled by a herd of cows. And so I just start screaming and waving my arms like, get out of here, get out of here. And they just kind of looked at me like, okay. And they wandered away. So I was like, okay, there's cows. There's got to be a house or something. I keep on going and a little ways further, I see a barn. It's a very dilapidated looking barn. It had, wood and a tin roof on it, but I was like, at least I can get out of the rain. I was so cold. By now I was shivering so hard that words can't describe the shivering. It felt like my bones were going to break. And I knew I needed to get out of the rain. I needed to get out of the cold and I needed to figure out what's going on. And so I made it to the barn. And when I got in there, it was like an old tool shed, really. And there was a tractor in there and there was a tarp folded up on the tractor. And so I got the tarp out and I was like, I'm just going to wrap up in it and try to conserve some of my body heat because I was shivering so hard. And so it was a dirt floor in the barn. So I was like, I'm going to curl up in a ball and just try to get as warm as I can and put this tarp over me and try to trap the heat in. And that's the last thing I remember for the next 4.5 hours. I lost consciousness at that point, probably just between hypothermia, the head injury. Yeah, I was out. Later on, I found out that 4.5 hours had gone by. I was stunned. I couldn't believe it because I was out. During that time.
Yeah. So I had run back to the house but had to get our son to climb back up to our property because it's a good 200 feet like lower. So it's a little bit of climbing. And so we got him up there. I got back out there. By the time I got back down to the creek, I didn't see her at all. I didn't see the kayak. The water was up, but I couldn't tell that a flash flood had met by. I was up even maybe 20 feet higher.
We kind of think that the flash flood, that all that debris went by when he decided to take my son back to the house and then come down and get me. So I get in the water. He kind of saw me around the corner, took Lane back up to the house, came back down the path. And during that time, probably took about 10 minutes. We think that that's when it happened. Because when he got down the path, he realized the water was quite a bit higher and I wasn't there. Well, so he's like,
I didn't realize it right then.
Okay.
I just didn't see you. So I went down the creek into our neighbor's property. And like, I'm not sure, but a good ways. I was following along just to see if I could see if you had pulled off or somewhere. And when I stopped and kind of really looked at the water, it was then, but that was like another, I don't know, 10 minutes before I realized, oh, this is a lot higher. And I could see way down the creek from my vantage point. And I was like, okay. So I stopped. Okay. Do I need to call for help or what can I do? And I thought that, you know, she's a very capable woman. She's done kayaking and things like that. She might be annoyed at me if I, you know, call for 911 if she was fine. So I thought, well, I know there's a bridge that crosses down like maybe 2 miles down the creek. So what I could do is I could drive to that. And I'm sure if she got to it, she would pull off and I could pick her up there.
That was the next logical place to pull out would be at the bridge.
Yeah. So, but of course, there's no direct route there. I'd, you know, run back up to the house, jump in my truck, and then drive like gravel road back to the highway, back to the bigger highway, and then exit to it and go all the way down to the creek. So I got there. I actually called a friend of mine, Eric, who lives real close to there, to meet me down there just in case he would get there sooner. And so he did beat me. I got down there, but she was not there. And the bridge, like the bridge, like the water was up to the bottom of the bridge and just about to, it was soon going to cross over the top of it. And also past the bridge, like the where the creek is, that land is actually lower than where the creek was. So it had all flooded.
So you knew the water was high.
Yeah. So I could not get past there, even if the bridge, even if I wanted to. So it's at that point that I realized this is way bigger than me and I need to call for help. However, where I was, I had no signal, so I had to drive back up to the highway. So then I called 911. They got me to the rescue services people, and the guy who's going to be taking care of the rescue operation, he told me, go ahead and go home. He got, of course, my information while I'm driving. So basically, I went back there and just waited for them to show up. My mom is staying with us. She just had her knee replaced 2 days before. You know, I got her praying, and luckily she was there to watch the kids while we were doing all that. So it was just a lot of waiting, called several friends to pray. I waited on calling her family because I didn't really want to open that can of worms until I knew for sure what's going on because they're all up in Wisconsin. So then the crew started showing up. The guy who's going to run the case, I don't remember his name, but he basically just hung out in his pickup at the Girard driveway.
He put a boat in.
He asked about if there was access to the creek, and there's a road that's near our house that goes down where they could get a boat in. So they did that. And so then it was a lot of just waiting inside. Every once in a while, he'd call me out to ask for something. Like he asked for a picture. And so I had a picture and then I sent the video, which turned out to be fortuitous that I took that video because it had a timestamp of when exactly she left.
And then, well, at one point you had gone out into the garage and.
Oh yeah. So when I went out to, he called me out to ask for that information. So I sent it to him, and as I was walking back in, there's two other rescue workers who were talking, like volunteers. And one of them said to the other, yeah, they just switched this from a rescue operation to a body recovery.
And they didn't know Steve was standing right there.
Yeah, the younger guy's back was to me, so he didn't see me come in. So just like, I don't know, it just really hit home. Like, I knew this was serious, but that was just another kind of, you know, slam to the chest type of thing.
Is that when you kind of just started talking to God at that point out on the porch? Just at what point did you have that talk with God?
Oh, that was when I was driving to the creek.
Oh.
Yeah. I was kind of letting out some of my frustration that she had done that, but also just talking with God about it. And you know, what was kind of my impactful thing is like, you know, my faith is important and it's important to my family. And I, even if the worst happens, I'm not going to abandon my faith. And it just feels like that was an important thing for me to say between me and God.
Hey, you were going to continue to raise the kids to love God and not be angry at God. And
you still be angry at God, but it doesn't, you know, bad things can happen because God has his own timing. So, you know, people might speculate, well, why didn't God save me in this circumstance? Well, you know, God has his own reasons. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway.
So while that was all going on, they had switched it from a rescue to a recovery because they had found my kayak and they didn't find me in it. And
actually, my friend saw it floating by.
Oh, Derek?
Yeah, he said it was floating upside down. He saw it going slowly by. And
did he tell you before the rescuers did?
I think they told me first, and then he called to check on me and told me about it.
That he saw it.
Someone actually brought the kayak back later that night.
We still have the kayak.
Yeah, we still have the kayak. Lost the paddle, but.
So anyway, back in the barn, I was suddenly startled awake by a clap of thunder. And I didn't know how much time had gone by. I just startled awake and the rain was coming. It was this torrential downpour and it was a metal roof. So you know how loud that was. It was just deafening. But this thunder startled me awake and I just realized, you know, I think I was feeling the pain now. And I was shivering so, so hard. And unless anyone's ever it's not your normal shivering. It's like bone jarring shivering. And I just started crying because I didn't know even where to start or what to do. And I knew I was in bad shape. Right then I heard clear as day, like you and I talking, a voice, a man's voice all around me in that barn above the rain said, get up and walk. If you don't walk now, you won't walk again. Get up and walk. I wasn't surprised. It didn't scare me. It didn't startle me. And again, I'm a woman of faith. And so I just knew it was God. I didn't even question it. And so I responded back. I just said, God, what do I do? And I remember just looking up and hot tears just running down. I said, God, what do I do? What do I do? And right then the rain on the roof just stopped. It didn't slowly taper. It went from to silence. And I was like, okay, I guess I get to get up and walk. I mean, that was my answer right there. I said, God, what do I do? He made the rain stop. So I got up and I wasn't walking well. I got out of the barn and I went maybe 30 steps out of that barn door. And I looked down the hill and way down the hill, was a rescuer all dressed in red. And he was looking in the shoreline. And I started screaming and yelling and he couldn't hear me because again, the water was so loud. It was deafening where he was. And it was probably a quarter mile that, we were probably about a quarter mile apart. Well, right then he tripped and he fell. And as he picked himself up, his gaze went up the hill at me and he saw me. So had he not tripped, he probably would not have looked. I couldn't have run to get to him. And so he sees me and he starts running up my way and I just collapsed at that point. And from that point, it was just like a flurry of activity. I was absolutely hysterical and he was trying to calm me down. The only way I could just, the relief was, like the first day I held my child and my child was born, just utter relief that I was rescued and I was going to live and I was going to see my husband again. I was going to see my kids again. And, my rescuer's name was Brandon. And so he radioed in and told the rescuers that he'd found me. And so they started getting, trying to get people out to me. And so it took a couple different vehicles to get me out of there because again, the bridge had flooded, the roads were flooded. And so it was kind of just a flurry of them picking me up, putting me, I think on like a four-wheeler, and then they put me in a truck, like a pickup truck. And as we were going down this road in the pickup truck, they were putting IVs in both my arms. So I had one first responder on either side of me putting IVs in. And then we finally made it out to the highway where an ambulance was staging to pick me up. And at that point, I started just losing consciousness. What I was thinking was I was absolutely exhausted and I couldn't keep my eyes open. I was so tired. I was like, okay, I'm safe now. I can just go to sleep. They'll take care of everything. They'll check me over and make sure I'm okay. And I just wanted to sleep. And, I could hear them all and they started slapping my face and saying, Nicole, stay with us, stay with us. And I remember being really annoyed that they were slapping me, like, quit slapping me. I'm right here. But I couldn't talk. I couldn't respond to them. I could hear everything they were saying. At one point, they said, we're losing her. We're losing her. Stop those fluids. And so what I found out later was they were actually warming me up too fast. They had two bags of heated saline solution, and they were squeezing them into me. And when you reheat someone too quickly, it actually throws them into shock. But I remember thinking, well, man, they think I'm dying. I'm not dying. I'm right here. And so I was trying so hard to open my eyes so I could respond to them and tell them, I'm not dying. You're not losing me. I'm here. And I finally got them open enough that they knew that I was, I was able to kind of tell them my name. They had asked me what my birthday was. And I knew I told them the wrong year. I knew I told them the wrong year, but I couldn't make the speech to tell them, wait a minute, that's not correct. I know it's like my brain was in slow motion. We got to the hospital and again, it's just another just flurry of activity. They were rolling me, checking me, x-rays, everything. The absolute miracle is, yes, I was beat up from head to toe. There wasn't an inch of my body that was not bruised and I can, if you want some pictures, I can send them to you. But I, when I hit that tree, I broke my nose and I had a,
that's what that sound was.
Yeah. That was that, that cartilage squishing. Ugh. And I had a really bad concussion. It was, I don't know if they'd call it a mild TBI, a brain injury, but it really affected my language. So I couldn't really work for about 2 months because my language, I would say things like vowels would get switched around. And so instead of saying dog, I might say deg. Or sometimes the end of the word would end up at the beginning of the word. And so I would just say random. What were some of the random words I would say?
That's the one I always think about. I don't remember.
My doctor for a while was like, well, just journal. So if there's like for like speech therapy or something, if there's like a pattern that we can see how your brain is changing the words around. And we noticed it more when I was tired. I was also very light sensitive. Like I couldn't stand fluorescent lights. So it took about 2 months for that concussion to resolve where I feel like I could function. And still to this day, it's been 9 years. If I'm tired, I'm really tired. I'll say the wrong word. I have difficulty with word finding, or words will come out funny. I had a crush injury to my calf. It was just short of being they call it a compartment syndrome. When the swelling is so much in the muscles that it damages the muscles, they were keeping an eye on it. They wanted to keep me in the hospital, but being a mom and knowing that my kids were traumatized by all I could think about was getting home to my kids. That's all I could think about. Steve had come to the hospital. He was there and, I was pretty much leaving AMA. We come from a medical background. And so I pretty much convinced the doctors that I know what to look for compartment syndrome. If my leg gets worse, I know when to come back in. I know if my, you know, what to look for a head injury, that if it's getting worse to come back in. And I think medical people make the worst patients because we're the most non-compliant. I probably should have stayed, but I was leaving. I had to get home to my kids and, well, you want to tell what it was like when you got the call?
Yeah, so I was sitting at our kitchen table just praying, and I got a text from the guy leading the rescue to, but it was kind of ominous, you know, especially if the last thing I heard was that it was a recovery. And so he sends a text that just says, "We found your wife. Come outside."
Oh my gosh.
You know, so I'm like, well, this is it. So I just square my shoulders, stand up, and just walk out there. I didn't tell anybody because I didn't want, you know, a scene before I went out there. So I went out there and he's like, "We found your wife. She's in an ambulance. She's got hypothermia, but they're taking her to the hospital."
Gosh.
Inside, all I could think of was, "But she's alive."
Yeah. Are you serious?
Like, yeah. So, you know, praise God. So I went inside and just said, "Guys, they found her. She's alive." And I heard my daughter from the basement, "Really?" And she comes running upstairs and they were all pretty much excited. Our son had been stoically.
Did you tell them at that time, Stephen, did you tell them that she could be not alive?
We didn't say that specifically, but you know, yeah. I think we were all thinking it.
And they were old enough to realize, like, okay,
it's dangerous.
They're still looking for my mom. And
the longer this goes on, the worse it gets.
So my kids experienced during that time, my daughter was very upset and she cried a lot during those. So if you were to ask her part of the story, she cried a lot. And then she saw my Jesus Calling book on my desk and she knew that I read that every morning. And so she's like, "Well, I'm going to read my mom's book because that's what she reads." And she sat down on the chair and later on, she's like, "Mom, every page I turned to, it said, it's going to be okay, that God's in control and he will take care of you." And she's like, "He was telling me that he was taking care of it." And again, this is a 10-year-old. And then my son during that time, he stood in a window that kind of overlooked our backyard where the creek was. And he stood there for a long time. And my mother-in-law, who again was staying with us while she was recovering from her surgery, she was concerned about him. And she said, "You know, Lane, are you doing okay? Are you all right, buddy?" And he was just very nonchalant. He said, "Yeah, God told me in the thunder that mom's coming home." And she's kind of questioning him. And she said, he said that in the thunder, God's voice was in the thunder, and he said, "Mom's coming home." And so he wasn't concerned because he just believed. He just, God told him that. And so that's, that was it. And, he was eight. Yeah. He's our very spiritual child. Has always been very in tune with God and very just the faith of a child. Even as a 17-year-old now, he just, he's just so in love with the Lord. He is so in love, and he hears from and he listens for him. And so this whole experience, now we've had 9 years to kind of digest and process everything. It's very clear that God spoke to each of us that day at different times in the way that we needed to hear him. That was very clear. As we were processing it, what became very clear was that the entire day became a metaphor, kind of for my life, from my perspective of the story. The day became a metaphor for my life. I had been dealing with a lot of grief and trauma over my dad had died by suicide a couple years earlier. So there's mental illness in our home. Growing up, it was a lot of chaos. And then our marriage was, you know, affected by, you know, the various things that were going on because of that. There's a lot of stress and strain. So our marriage wasn't the greatest. I was dealing with a lot of depression and my own mental illness that I wasn't aware of. And the way I was dealing with it was, you know, reading self-help books and going to doctors and trying to get on medication and going to counselors and trying different types of therapies. And, you know, we went to church and all that, but it was never really, you know, how about you give this to God? It was, you know, we can fix this. You know, we do all the things. We'll go to the counselors. We'll read the self-help books. But nothing was working. No matter what I grasped at, was just getting ripped out of my hands, kind of like the creek. So if you think of the creek as life, it was very tumultuous at that time. And I was just grabbing at everything that came by my way to try to save myself. And nothing was working. Everything was getting ripped away from me. I was getting beat up. I was getting slammed against rocks and pulled underwater and almost drowned. And it just got more and more chaotic. And it wasn't until I completely had nothing left, and it was just me alone with, I just let it go. I just said, "Creek, take me." And it wasn't until I was at that point that I actually heard God. It wasn't until I was completely desperate and had run out of options that I heard God that day. And I heard him clear as day. And he was always right there, but just didn't hear him. I was distracted by everything else. And get up and walk. And actually, it was just a month ago, our son Lane said, "Mom, you know that Jesus says get up and walk like 3 times in the gospel." So I was like, yeah. He really does. I'm like going back and looking like he really does. He tells his people to get up and walk. And they obeyed him. And so after that, the days afterwards were just, I had this renewed, my life was just renewed. My heart and soul was ignited for the Lord. I just don't even know how to describe it. I just knew that God had given me another chance at life and said, "Don't screw this up." Everything looked brighter, more beautiful. I was thankful for every little thing. I was, you know, nothing got me down. My depression was gone. We had decided, we were in church a few weeks, maybe a couple months later. And there was they announced a mission trip to Honduras. And I was like, "Let's go." And he'd always wanted to do a mission trip. He had gone on mission trips to Russia when he was in high school, and he'd always wanted to go with me. And I was always like, "Yeah, you know, we've got kids and we've got jobs." And, you know, I always had a reason. It wasn't a top of my priority. So when that came up, I was like, "Let's go." Just nothing was stopping me anymore. I was excited about everything. And I was like, I wanted to hear God. I heard God. And I mean, what did you notice?
Yeah, definitely. You just had a lot more, I wouldn't say a lot more to live for, but you just realized how much that you really had. And, you know, he literally, you know, spits you out of the water like Jonah out of the whale.
Yeah.
You know,
I literally was spit out of that creek. Like, yeah.
So, you know, he's not done with you yet. So even now, if you have days when you're down, we still remind ourselves like you're here for a reason. So,
yeah,
you know, this too shall pass and we'll be on to the next thing.
Yeah. So it was very profound. And we've had 9 years to process this. People are like, how are you not just a mess when you tell the story? And it's like, we've had 9 years to process it. We've had 9 years for God to reveal all of these lessons in it. And it is, sometimes when I do talk to God now, I'm like, now, God, I don't need the creek. I don't need another thing like the creek to happen. I hear you. You've got my attention. But, you know, the further it gets away from it, yes, we have our days where we just feel like the storms are too heavy. And I think it's in those moments that we just have to become quiet and listen. He's right there. He'd never left me. Even that bird soaring in the sky was him saying, you're not alone. I'm watching you. I see you, and you're not alone out here. And I think that was just the biggest thing we got out of it. And you know, our kids, we had a lot of emotional, like some PTSD after that to work through, of course.
That is an incredible story. And whenever I tell people that it's an incredible story, I always hesitate, because there's a lot of times some of the stories that people tell us are so tragic and stuff. And it's really weird to tell somebody that's an incredible story. But what's incredible is how God takes our chaos and our darkest moments, and he turns them into light, right? And he is able to turn it into something beautiful. And you guys touched on almost all of the thoughts that I had while you're telling your story, with like the metaphor for life and just how sometimes we're in the middle of this creek, this raging water. Sometimes it's from decisions that we make ourselves, but sometimes we just get thrown into this creek, right? And even in that vantage point, we can see some of the dangers that are coming, right? So that big rolling water with all of that stuff where, Nicole, you're literally thinking like, this could be the end. You know, I don't know how. And you're literally thinking about drowning. What is this going to look like? How does somebody drown? You know, and all of those things, that's a perfect representation of life for all of us. You know, there's times that we're at a really good vantage point, we're up out of the danger, and we can still see the danger, right? Or Steve, for you, we're in a position, like say our kids, you guys are about to be empty nesters for good. You know, you're not going to have control over your kids and everything that they do. And there are times that they get into situations where it may seem like they're not going to get out, right? And then all of a sudden we see a bird and it kind of gets our focus back a little bit. Or I don't know that I've ever been really at the breaking point in my life where, metaphorically, of course, I'm about to take in that breath of nothing but water. And then all of a sudden, I mean, when you're telling that story, I imagine somebody, an angel, reaching in and ripping you out of the water.
Yeah, it had to have been. I mean, there was no act of human will that could have got me out of those branches. I mean, I didn't know if I was upside down. I didn't even know what orientation I had gotten caught into that. I just was thrashing chaos.
Yeah. And just that image of everything is just so beautiful. And I'm so grateful that that's where my mind goes, that there was some divine help there. I'm grateful to have that knowledge, but not everybody has that knowledge or that faith system. You know, people can hear your story, I mean, we probably could go back and listen to the number of miracles that you have been able to, in hindsight, look back on and recognize now as miracles. I mean, multiple, just the timing of everything, the timestamp of the photo that helped everything. What was his name? The guy that helped,
Brandon,
that found you, Brandon.
Yeah.
Him tripping. Come on. Like,
right.
There was,
he never would have, you know, we got to meet him later, and there was like a recognition ceremony and stuff that we got to, meet him with our family. He never would have gone up into that barn. He was looking literally in the shoreline for my body. So
right.
There was no reason that he would have hiked all the way up that hill and looked into the barn when he was looking for a missing kayaker. So if he hadn't tripped right then and his gaze had gone up the hill, all divine intervention. I mean, people could say that's luck, but when you have that many nuggets of luck, it's like, I don't think this is luck anymore. This is divine acts of God and intervention to, and it was so just, it's almost amusing when you're after the fact, you've had this many years to digest and process it. It's, God is literally like a director of an orchestra. He's just like letting it happen. And he already knew all this was going to happen, you know? And he was like, what kind of nuggets can I get them to glean from this master plan? You know, he allows us to do things and to make mistakes. That's what got me into that situation. I made a series of poor choices, but God can then use those poor choices and the consequences for his master story. You know, I still feel like it's his story to tell and direct.
You know, initially afterwards, I felt kind of guilty that I hadn't called for help sooner. But then after hearing her story and just the way that it worked out, I was like, no, God had this in hand. Like, you know, no matter what would have happened, he would have made the timing work. So I just kind of let that go to God. So
yeah, because if you try to manipulate any part of the story, if Steve had called 10 minutes sooner, the boat that had Brandon in it would have dropped him off 10 minutes. You know, they would have missed me. If everything didn't happen right when it did, the story wouldn't be what it is. So,
well, or maybe God would have just adjusted it. It's so normal for you to react like that, though, too. Like, I mean, yeah, you have this guilt, but at the same time, if any of us were in that situation, I think it's like you don't want to make your spouse mad by calling, or, you know, like you're thinking of all these things. Like, we've all gone through that, so it's understandable.
Well, it's almost like, too, like, am I overreacting to be panicking right now? Because she could be at the bridge, and I just need to, you know, it's unfortunate she didn't get out here, but...
How much time had gone by from that time that you were driving?
I mean, probably 30 to 40 minutes. You know, you don't realize how much time is passing at the time because you're trying to manage it all.
But again, too, well, we're to get out into that remote area. You don't just do a straight shot. It's gravel roads.
Sure.
It's flooded gravel roads.
A long way around.
Torrential driving rain. No phone signal. So he got out there, and once he realized I need to call 911, now he had to drive all the way back out of the Mark Twain National Forest to get phone signal again. So even if he wanted to call right when he needed to, he could not have because there was no phone signal. So there was a lot. He beat himself up about it, but there were a lot of barriers to him being able to call at the moments he wanted to call. Of course, and I beat myself up about a lot of things. Our kids, you know, the lessons our kids had to learn off of it too were not lessons I would have wanted an 8 and 10 year old to have to learn. But now when you talk to them at 17 and 20, they see it as, it helped shape them. You know, my daughter learning to go to God when she was feeling this fear, this overwhelming dread and fear, to go to him and to pray and to be comforted by him. My son was just, his faith was reaffirmed that just trust God. He's got this. Also, my daughter was very angry with me. I tend to be kind of an impulsive person. I'm always like, it's fine. It'll be fine. And she's more of a cautious person. And that day when I decided to go out there and do that, she did too mention, Mom, I don't think that's a good idea. You shouldn't do that. And I blew her off. And that, you know, it wounded her. And later on, I had to apologize to her and tell her that, you know, her feelings are valid. And so there was so many lessons and things that we had to, you know, that we had to heal through, and relationships were strengthened from it. And yeah, there's so many lessons, so many.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have just a couple more thoughts. You had mentioned that leading up to that, you know, you were dealing with some other things, mental things. And on the surface, as far as society goes, you were doing all of the right things, right? Reading the self-help books, seeing a therapist. You know, you were going to church, but the way I understand it and the way that you were saying it is you were doing all of those things and God was kind of a supplementation to that. And I don't want to steer people away from reading self-help books and going to a therapist and stuff. That's all really good stuff. But the answer and the focus should be and has to be God first, with a supplementation of all of those other things.
I think it's the peace that God gives you through that. Because I'm on medication. I have bipolar type 2. And we realized after my dad died that that's probably what I was dealing with. It's hereditary. And so I will have to be on medications for the rest of my life. And I'm okay with that. But I think it's the peace and the comfort that God gave in that situation that I had never felt before. That once I felt that and I could rest in that, that's what I lean into now. I don't lean into, yes, I need the medications and to physiologically regulate things. Mm-hmm. But I have the relationship with God that gives me the peace and the rest and the comfort that I need that I wasn't finding in any of the other things. Like, medicine can't do that for me either. So yeah, you're absolutely right. I was seeking all of, in a way, some of those things, you know, the right things, none of them were wrong, but right, they weren't satisfying me. They were not, I didn't have the final piece yet, for real. Like, I needed to be quiet and still and hear God, and not just chaos, grabbing at things and desperately trying to save myself, is what I was doing. And it wasn't working, was it?
But that's a beautiful thought too, is to think that even in the chaos, even in the most crazy situation that we can think of, there's still a way for us to find peace and to feel that peace, right? And it's a skill. It really is. But it's something that is possible, and God is the very best at calming the seas.
I think people too don't know. I didn't know. I mean, I know about praying and stuff, but I don't think I'd ever cried out to God. Like, I cried out to him, God, what do I do? And his answer, it wasn't words that time, but his answer was clear. The rain stopped, like, immediately. And we don't have to hear his voice either. We don't have to hear his voice to and hear words to know. I think if we're willing to listen and you're at a point where you're crying out to God and you're desperate to hear from him, he will reveal himself. He will. Mm-hmm. If you are crying out to him with an open heart, and he will reveal himself. That's what he wants us to do.
And just most of the times it's in a way that we don't expect. I mean, it could be like you get a phone call from somebody you haven't talked to in years who, like, you know, you're having a down moment and they just call you out of the blue. And that phone call, I've heard of a situation where that talked to somebody's from stopped them from taking their own life just because someone called them and got them out of their head for a minute. So, you know, it's not always going to be the miraculous. I mean, he just uses the ordinary many times because that's it will suffice, or a word or a song or whatever the case may be.
Yeah. It can be a very subtle message, but I think he will reveal himself. If your heart is longing for him, he will reveal for sure.
I think that he works through other people, right? And we can be saved by other people. And that's why we love this podcast, because we never want people to feel alone in their grief or their trials or whatever the case may be. And we've learned so much from other people on how to handle, you know, those trials or the hard days. So your story is remarkable, and it definitely does need to be in a book. I hope that you write it, because we'll buy it. We'll be the first to buy it.
Sometimes God needs us to be an angel for somebody, and we just have to be willing to listen and willing to get up and walk.
I do have a question. So have you been able to, you know, get into a canoe and be fine, and, you know, how
it was a kayak
or kayak, yeah. Not a canoe, kayak.
I've been in my kayak again, but only on glass, like water, like not moving water. I did go in a canoe on a couple canoe trips where the water was moving pretty good, and it was scary for me. It was triggering. But I've gone enough times now that I can tell the difference between the water I was in and the water. I think initially just that PTSD, the rushing water sound, and just seeing moving water would get that physiological response of, you know, my stomach hurting and my heart racing. We went whitewater rafting the next summer or two summers later.
Two summers.
I had no fun at all, but the family really wanted to do it. It's something that they've always, and I had always wanted to do it before this. And I didn't want to be the one that ruined it for everyone. So I was like, sure, I'm in a boat with a professional and there's ropes to hang on to. What could possibly go wrong? Then he starts talking about how this is what we do if someone gets thrown out of the boat. You know, we all had a role to play. And I'm just like, oh, no, no.
Luckily, that would be terrible.
Yeah, we made it. No one got thrown out of the boat. But yeah, it's gotten a lot better. We still enjoy kayaking, just not whitewater raft or kayaking.
She does not like being cold.
The cold is honestly the worst. I mean, I don't know. I've emphasized it enough. Again, there's shivering and there's bone crushing, bone breaking shivering. And if I shiver, I get this irrational panic that I'm never going to stop shivering again. And it starts to become painful in my mind. I cannot stand to shiver or be cold. And it's very hard for me to get warmed up. But yeah. In the ambulance, they couldn't get a temperature read on me. They were not even able to get, so however cold that is, they couldn't read my temperature. Jeez. I was that cold. Wow. But yeah, so that would be another, cannot stand to shiver or be cold. But the days afterwards, I would, I woke up a couple times with nightmares, like my blankets were tangled around my ankles, my legs, and I, you know, felt like I was trapped and thrashing. Mm-hmm. That happened a few times. A couple times the years afterwards, just having a heavy rain, if I opened the front door, I could hear the creak, and I'd be like, nope, and shut the door. Don't even want to hear it.
Blame you.
So, but yeah.
Jeez.
Wow, what a story. And
yeah.
Yeah, when we go through things and we're able to look back and see God's hand in all of it, that's like with our story, you know, just being able to see the miracle after miracle after miracle, it's mind-blowing. But for us, we don't get all of those huge miracles every day, right? It's so important for us to remember what he has done for us. And just with how life goes, it's really easy for us to forget and to, again, put God on the back burner. But we have to keep all of those things at the forefront and remember what he has done for us. I'm so grateful for you guys for being willing to share.
Yeah.
But before we go, we need to ask you both to share one thing that you know to be true.
I know that God is real. Like, it's just, I don't know if I could even just explain it to someone, you know, theologically, how I know. I just know that there is a God and he is bigger than me. He is better than me. He is in control and I am not in control. No matter what happens, his story is perfect and whatever happens was intended to be. If it's a tragedy, it hurts him just as much as it hurts us, but he can use everything in our lives for his purpose. And that gives me a lot of comfort. No matter how bad it gets, what I know to be true is that God is in control of it, and it will always be exactly according to his plan, and his plan is perfect and not mine. So
I love that.
Mm-hmm. I'd say I know that it kind of similar to this, that God's in control and it basically everything is going to work out. I mean, even if it doesn't work out, maybe especially if it doesn't work out the way that we expect it to or plan it to, you know, we all have this idea of what's going to happen in our life as we're growing up, and then it's completely different. And so even if that day had wound up completely different, eventually it would have been all right. It would have been a coming to terms with loss and grief. And that's really part of our world, part of our society. You know, I think as Americans, we sometimes, we don't like to deal with grief. So we shove it aside. We don't sing songs that are songs of mourning, but there's so many of the Psalms were people crying out because they were hurting. You know, Jesus said, blessed are those who mourn. And so for those who are in that experience, like God hears you, he's going to be with you through that. But I'm thankful that in this case, it was different. So,
well, thank you again, both.
Yeah.
So much. It was a pleasure to be able to sit with you and hear your story and feel God's love.
Yeah. Thank you for having the platform to share. Kind of what we were saying earlier is we have this story that we shouldn't be keeping to ourselves. We should be telling it because people deserve to hear it. We don't deserve to keep it to ourselves. So thank you for having a platform for us to be able to tell our story to the people who deserve to hear it. Mm-hmm. It's not for ours to keep. It's for us to share. And so we're really kind of finding that out 9 years later that people need to hear this. God brings people in your life and we don't know who your audience is that needs to hear it. And so thank you for reaching out and for letting us share. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah. A lot of times, you know, and this goes for all of you listeners out there, we get stuck in a little box where we think my story won't help anybody. Nobody needs to hear my story. And that couldn't be farther from the truth. Those thoughts and those feelings don't come from God. They come from the adversary. And God wants you to share things. There are things that we all have that people need to hear. And that's what we're here for, just to help everybody and to learn from each other and to grow and hopefully get to where we're trying to go.
Well, and just your angels among us. I think some of us have a hard time telling our stories because, well, would anyone believe me? You know, like sure. Some of the supernatural stuff or the spiritual stuff, it's hard for people to grasp because it is not something we can explain. And I think at first, you know, that experience was so real to me I can still hear his voice. And how do you defend that to people who may doubt or not? And that maybe was some of my hesitancy in the beginning was, you know, people are going to downplay it. They're going to say, oh, you hit your head too hard. You're hearing things and stuff like that. No, I heard God's voice and it was God and he was all around me and I heard him and I heard the command and I obeyed his command. And so I think sometimes it's hard to sometimes share our angel stories because they're not easily explained or someone will try to explain it away and diminish the experience. And I'm at the point now where I know what I heard. I'm convicted by it. And they can take it for, you know, they can diminish it if they want, but it'll never diminish what I heard that day and what happened. So it's a good, I think we need to not, I think we need to tell our angel stories more because I think it happens far more than than we talk about, because it's just one of those things that's kind of scary when we can't explain it. But
yep.
They're our favorite stories.
Yeah. That's what we're here for.
That's what the platform's here for. And honestly, I'm kind of jealous that you were able to hear his voice. Like, how cool, you know? Hopefully one day I'll be able to hear that actual voice.
We all will. We all will someday. Yeah. We'll hear him.
Well, thank you guys so much, and we so appreciate you.
Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely.
On that note, go look for those angels.
Thanks for joining us on Angels Among Us. You can find us on YouTube and wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow along for more stories of everyday miracles and reminders that angels are among us. If you have a story to share, please email or DM us with a brief summary. We'd love to hear from you. And remember, when we are waiting, God is working.
Any team that's tested AI tools for data has seen the pattern already. AI gives a different number than your BI tool. Metrics don't match across teams. And inevitably, users lose trust. It turns out, turning on AI is easy, but making it work on data is not. Hex AI was built to solve this. The key is nailing context. Hex is built to unify and curate your data context for agents. Data teams can observe, govern, and continuously improve every AI answer, so answers get smarter the more your team asks. The result? Your entire organization asks data questions in natural language and trusts the answers. Not because the AI got lucky, because it knows your business and its data. Because that's what an AI analytics platform should do. Join data teams from Cursor, Lovable, Ramp, AWS, and over 2,000 more at hex.ai.